Paramahansa Parad Chakacharya asked the Kadusha to Sri Sriman, His Divine Grace, श्री भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद की, इस्कॉन फाउंडर आचार्य श्रील प्रभुपाद की, श्री श्री भगवद गीता की, श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की, श्री युग धर्म हरि नाम संकीर्तन की, निथाय गौर प्रेमानंदी ग्लोरीज टू दी असेंबल डिवोटीज, ऑल ग्लोरीज टू दी असेंबल डिवोटीज, ऑल ग्लोरीज टू श्री गुरु एंड श्री गौर हंगा। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। So in the attempt to resurrect the class on Bhagavad Gita each evening, we began a couple nights ago just beginning to speak on selected verses from the Gita, because prior to that there had been no systematic program. So continuing with that same theme tonight, I'll again chose a verse from one chapter. This verse is from chapter, the first night we chose the verse from chapter 6, last night chapter 7, this night chapter 8. And this chapter is entitled Attaining the Supreme. There's two verses which are connected to each other, which are really key verses within the Gita. That is 8.5 and 8.6. It's always a difficult choice between the two, but I choose 8.5 today. Maybe we can all chant the verse responsively. I'll try to chant it very slowly and distinctly. Ante kale chamam neva, ante kale chamam eva, smaram mukva kalevaram, kalevaram, ya prayanti samadbhavam, yanti nasyatra samsayaha. Ante kale chamam eva, smaram mukva kalevaram, ya prayanti samadbhavam, yanti nas yatra samsaya. Translation: and whoever at the end of one's life quits his body remembering me alone at once attains my nature, of this there is no doubt. Purport: by his divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In this verse, the importance of Krishna consciousness is stressed. Anyone who quits his body in Krishna consciousness is at once transferred to the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord is the purest of the pure. Therefore, anyone who is constantly Krishna conscious is also the purest of the pure. The word smaran, remembering, is important. Remembrance of Krishna is not possible for the impure soul who has not practiced Krishna consciousness in devotional service. Therefore, one should practice Krishna consciousness from the very beginning of life. If one wants to achieve success at the end of his life, the process of remembering Krishna is essential. Therefore, one should constantly, incessantly chant the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Lord Chaitanya has advised that one be as tolerant as a tree, tayor iva suhishnuna. There may be so many impediments for a person who is chanting Hare Krishna. Nonetheless, tolerating all these impediments, one should continue to chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, at the end of one's life, one can have the full benefit of Krishna consciousness. End of verse. Translation once again. And whoever at the end of his life quits his body, remembering me alone, that once attains my nature, of this there is no doubt. Om Agyan Timirandasya Gena Jena Salakaya Chaksu Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shukadaveda Maha Sri Chaitanya Manobi Stam Stapti Tam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadati Kam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Brahmunityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasari Gaur Bhaktivindam Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, here in the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is giving the formula for success. That is, that at the end of one's life determines the destination one achieves in one's next existence. Therefore, life is more or less meant for preparing oneself for death, ultimately. Now Krishna says in another verse in Bhagavad Gita, those who worship the demigods go to the demigods, those who worship the forefathers go to the forefathers, those who worship ghosts and spirits take birth among such beings, and those who worship me come to me. According to how one focuses one consciousness in life, in devotion, one will achieve the results at the end of one's life. Life is like an examination. The examination is to pass the test of developing our consciousness of God. The whole form of human life is ultimately to awaken one's God consciousness. And that is mentioned throughout the various scriptures that ultimately human life is meant for God realization. Tato Brahma Jigyasa, Krishna, or not, I'm sorry, in Srimad Bhagavatam, the first aphorism from the Vedanta Sutra is that now one has a human form of birth, and that birth is an opportunity for perfection of one's life. It's explained that the individual living soul has been transmigrating from one body to another through various species of life. Sometimes in a favorable situation, and sometimes in an unfavorable situation, sometimes in a situation in between. That is up, down, and in between. Or we say higher planets, middle planets, and lower planets. Taking various forms of life, the soul has been enjoying and suffering the threefold miseries. Karanam guna sanga syo sarasa jani janmasu. Meeting happiness and distress in various species of life has been the conditioned soul's nature for countless amounts of lifetimes. Coming to the human form of life and coming to the opportunity to perfect that human form of life, one comes to devotional service. Devotional service is the exit out of the material world, ultimately to attain one's eternal nature again in the spiritual world from whence one has come from. So this is like the doorway out. And of course, life is meant to perfect our consciousness in Krishna. And here it's explained that Krishna says that perfection means to remember me at the time of death. People like to especially in Western societies, not so much in Eastern, but in Western societies, they like to somehow or other forget the idea that death exists. The general conditioned souls live in such a way as to mold their life in such a way as to act in such a way that they're going to live forever, or at least develop a consciousness that there's no such thing as death. But Krishna says that which is born dies, and that which is dies also is subject to rebirth. So one should not lament for the eternal soul. So death is a fact of life. It's part of life. But what is it? It's an exit. And it's a doorway into either a higher existence or a lower existence. It's an opportunity to reap the results of all of one's activities within that lifespan. Culminates at the time of death. And so we find in various cultures and various countries around the world that there are some types of rituals or performances in order to assist one in the process of attaining a better destination after death. And that is unnatural. Of course, in Western society, that's not so much there in a developed way, although people pray and sometimes call in the priest or something like that. But in other societies, there's actually a great arrangements to assist the soul in ultimately achieving God consciousness at the time of death. So what is death? Ultimately, death is a phenomena of this body. It's like everything else in this material world. It is part of our existence that's related to this body. This body has generally two reactions, things that are auspicious, are favorable for bodily development, and things that are inauspicious, or against the idea of bodily satisfaction. Death is considered the annihilation of all of one's activities within this particular sojourn. It is simply a chapter in one's existence. It's not the end of one's existence. Death is not an end. It's simply a doorway into a different realm of existence. People think that death is... of course, we find, if you study literature and other writings, you find that we hear about what is death. Shakespeare, in his poetic way, describes death. He says, "Ah, there's the rub." In other words, okay, everything's going along, but then there's a thing you can't deal with. In Bengal, they have a saying amongst the ordinary people, "What is the worst thing? Death." Now, ultimately, it takes away all of one's plans, aspirations in life. And no one can beat death. In the history of existence, or at least in Vedic culture, there are so many stories surrounding this phenomena of life. And there's one... Prabhupada explains that there is one story where one person did beat death, but only one. It's a famous story in the Vedic culture. And we understand that as there are different demigods in charge of various aspects of creation and maintenance and existence of the universal affairs, there is a lord of death also. His name is Yamaraj. You can also, if you study other cultures and other religions, you'll find his name is similar. Sometimes they call him Yama. Now, Yamaraj is actually a deputed agent by the Lord to punish those persons who are sinful after death. He comes through the agency of his servants, the Yamadutas, who are very fierce, ugly, horrible, terrible-looking creatures. It's explained that the conditioned soul forgets the experience of death from one lifetime to another because it's such a horrible experience. That is, those who are sinful, that is, we're not talking about devotees, we're talking about sinful people, and that these agents who come along to take the soul encased in the subtle body to Yamaraj are so gruesome and horrible that it's such a that the consciousness is blotted out from more lifetime to lifetime. It's such a traumatic experience. So these personalities, who are called Yamadutis, they come and they take the soul to Yamaraj. So there's one story wherein there was one lady, her name was Savitri. And Savitri, she was a chaste and saintly lady, somewhat pious. And she prayed to Yamaraj, because he is actually a devotee of God. He's one of the foremost of all devotees. It's interesting, Yamaraj has been given the power by the Lord to know the activities of the conditioned soul. In other words, God is situated in the heart of all living entities, and God is keeping track of all of our activities. So for those who are sinful, Yamaraj keeps track of those activities also. But he's given the power by the Supreme Lord to carry out this function. He's given the power by the Lord to understand the activities of the conditioned soul in this material world. So this lady, Savitri, she prayed to Yamaraj, "My dear Yamaraj, please give me a nice son." And it's customary sometimes that people pray to different demigods, different highly placed beings for some material benediction. So she followed the rules and regulations of worship, and she prayed to Yamaraj for a son. So this was prior to her marriage. And then she was destined to become married. And she selected one husband whose name was Satavan. Now, in Vedic culture, it is customary that the husband and wife go to, prior to the marriage, they go to the astrologer to find out if their astrological charts are compatible, if their natures are compatible, so marriage will be more easily entered into in a very pleasing way. This is part of Vedic culture. People get their astrological charts done to find out compatibility before making the attempt to get married. In the West, the only compatibility is, you know, if she makes my hair stand on end, then that's compatibility, you know, vice versa. You know. If I get an electric shock simply by the presence of the opposite sex, then that's considered compatible, right? This is the way we do things in the Western society. No real intelligent way to decide. You know, sometimes your friends, your family members, your well-wishers give you all kinds of advice, and still, because you are been shot by the arrow of Cupid, you can't discriminate between what's up and what's down. This is life in the material world. But in Vedic culture, there was a precautionary measure in order to ensure good marital arrangements, and that was astrological chart. So Savritti and Satavan, they went to an astrologer. And the astrologer told them that Satavan is destined to die on the day of the marriage. So, like Prabhupada is describing the story, he says, well, love is blind. So she went ahead and married him anyway. And he died on the marriage day, just as was predicted by the astrologer. So Yamaraj came personally to take away her husband. So he's taking away her husband. And then while he was taking away her husband, she was so attached to her husband that she was following Yamaraj. And Yamaraj says, "Why are you coming? I'm taking your husband away. He's now my possession. He will be duly given the results of his activities." But she said to him, "But my dear Yamaraj, I have worshipped you for a son, and you have granted me that desire. Now, you granted me that boon. Now, I don't have a husband, so how will I have a son? And I am a chaste and faithful lady. Once in Vedic culture, a woman gets married once. Only once. There's no question of remarriage, no question of divorce. That was Vedic culture. So, therefore, she wasn't able to fulfill her desire to have a son because she had no husband. So Yamaraj thought, he said, I think I made a mistake. So he returned her husband. Prabhupada also said this is the purity of chastity, that chastity is so powerful that it can produce many, many wonderful results. We have the story of Gandhari, who was voluntarily accepted blindness because her husband was blind, and she became so powerful. And simply by the glancing of her eyes upon the body of her son Diodhana, his body became like steel. It was invincible practically on the battlefield. So this was the power of chastity. So the Yamaraj said, oh, maybe I made a mistake. So he returned her husband. In this story, if you go to India, you'll find that in the temples and in the culture, people talk about the story of Savitri Satavan. This is the history of one such lady who was so chaste and so faithful that she was able to save her husband from death. But Prabhupada said, there's been no second story. No one else has beaten death. And Prabhupada, along with this story, talks about one man. He was thinking, Yamaraj, he's a gentleman. And therefore, if I simply smear my body with stool, then when it's time for death, Yamaraj will not come and take me, because it'll be a very abominable situation. And Yamaraj, he's a gentleman. But Prabhupada said it didn't work. Yamaraj came and took him away anyway. So no one can beat what we call the force of time. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, time I am. I come to engage all men, except for you, the Pandavas. Everyone on this battlefield will be killed. And it's explained that time is that force which takes away everything. So this body comes in time, and this body ends in time, and that time is death. But for one who is Krishna conscious, for one who has developed one's relationship with Krishna, time has a different effect, in that time brings one rather more and more away from a fearful situation rather than towards a fearful situation. Because we find that people in the material world generally, who live for the sake of this body, live a very fearful existence because they are very much afraid of death. Death is a fearful thing, and anyone who lives for this body lives in fear, because ultimately the body will be taken away. So that fear aspect is there. Prabhupada says, from the highest person in existence, Lord Indra, down to the Indra Gopacharam, everyone lives in fear, because ultimately time is that force that takes away this body. Jai Shri Shri Kishore Kishori Ki Jai. But Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that this time factor does not affect the devotees. For one who is on the path of self-realization, for one who is on the path of Krishna consciousness, time works to bring about one's relationship with Krishna more and more. Therefore, for a devotee, a death, and for a materialistic person, death are two opposite things. For a materialist, Prabhupada uses the example, is that a cat can carry a kitten in its mouth, and a cat carries a rat in its mouth. For the rat, the cat is death, and for the kitten, the cat is mother. So both, the cat is the same, But for one, it's death personified, and the other one, it's love, it's mother. So, in the same way, that a devotee, one who's fixed in Krishna consciousness, one who lives to serve the Lord and develop one's relationship with the Lord, time works to bring one closer to the Lord. And death is that cessation of this material existence where one is promoted again into the association of the Lord. So therefore, for a devotee, there's no question of death. There's no question of death. Death is simply the cessation of material activities. For one who has given up material activities, there's no question of death, because one has already died. Sometimes we say spiritual life means to die before you die. Die to the idea of material life. Die to the idea of death. Then one has to remember him at the time of death. That's the actual test. Because whatever one remembers at the time of death, Krishna says, that's where you go. So sometimes, mistakenly, people think, well, I can just do whatever I want throughout my life, and then when death comes, I'll just think of God. We might use an example, which is a crude example. It's like if you're going to maybe college and you're trying to get your degree. So if you don't go to the classes, if you don't hear the lectures, if you don't do the homework, then if you just show up for the final exam, very unlikely you will pass. And sometimes people, you know, they do that. And they go to school and they just, they don't really care, but they just go for the key times. And then at the end they get their cheat sheets out and they cheat. But Prabhupada said in spiritual life there's no cheat. You can't cheat on this game. This game is cheat proof. So the point is that we have to live our life in such a way as to develop one's devotional consciousness now, and then when death comes, one will easily make the transition to the spiritual realm. Because whatever is dear to the conditioned soul now will be dear at the time of death. Because whatever one lives for, one will also think at the time of death. There's different ways one can die. Usually for those who live a materialistic life, it's explained that their whole life flashes before them within a few seconds. And in that flash, they can see practically their entire life. And they become very much fearful, and they try to hang on to something within that experience. And that hanging on to something projects them to that consciousness in their next birth. They're given another womb, they're given another set of another material body to act out that desire again in their next life. Whatever you think of at the time of death, that's where you go. So therefore, death is a very important part of one's life, in that it brings one ultimately either closer to Krishna or farther away from Krishna. It's an opportunity to get the results of all of one's activities. So one should never be fearful of death. One should be fearful of forgetting Krishna. That's the real fear. Because death is natural. No one can avoid death. It's part of life. That which is born dies. So this material body comes and it also goes. But the important point is what we do at the time of death. So therefore Krishna says, Ante kale cha mam me. Well, at the end of life, one who remembers me will ultimately come to me. So one has to practice that throughout one's life. And Krishna Prabhupada said, therefore one should incessantly chant the Hare Krishna Mahamantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Through that chanting process, one purifies their consciousness, where one transcends the bodily conception of life. And in that transcendence, one starts to understand and realize their nature as soul, distinct from the body. We are not these material bodies. Death is the proven experiment. It's the lab of life. It's the experiment that you understand you're not this body, because ultimately you have to leave it. You have to go somewhere else. You have to go. The body goes one way, you go somewhere else. It's either, there's three destinations for the body. They say ashes, stool, or what's the other one? Dust. Okay. Ashes, stool, or dust. That's the three destinations of this body. In India, if an ordinary person dies, they burn the body. That's ashes. If a saintly person dies, they bury the body. And that's dust. And sometimes for people, they just throw the body out in the street. And then sometimes it's eaten by vultures or dogs or what else. And it becomes the stool of that animal. And so that's the three destinations of this material body, ultimately. We go somewhere else. We leave this material realm. And the soul, the spirit, which is actually the real person, which is understood by consciousness. Consciousness is a symptom of the soul. And our consciousness takes us to that realm where our consciousness has been developed throughout this existence. So therefore, Prabhupada emphasizes here that if we want to get a higher destination, if we want to ultimately attain the goal of life, we have to incessantly chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So, at the end of life, one can have the full benefits of Krishna consciousness. That's it. So one must purify themselves by the chanting of the holy names of the Lord. Okay, so these are a few simple points on the eternal nature of the soul and the nature of the destination of this body. Is there any questions or comments on anything? Yes?
I was wondering, if the Yamadutas, do they torture the subtle body, or do they torture when they take the subtle body?
Yes.
Do they also have subtle bodies too?
Yes. It's explained in the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. There are 28 hellish planets. Sometimes they say 22, but then there's an also 28. Two numbers are given. The authorities say 28. And that according to one's sinful life, one is taken by the Yamadutas to one of these hellish planets, and one is given due punishment. Now that punishment is similar to the punishment of a dream. In other words, it's just like when you're dreaming and you're asleep, and you're experiencing the experience of the dream. Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant, but actually there's an experience there. So this punishment is like a dream state, but it exists much longer than an ordinary dream. So therefore one is suffering in that situation where the subtle body is being tortured. The subtle body consists of the mind, the intelligence, and the ego. So we understand that mental pain can be just as severe or even more severe than physical pain. People hardly ever commit suicide because of physical pain, but they do commit suicide due to emotional and mental pain. So that is more severe. So we hear that in the scriptures it mentions that the soul is taken in a subtle body and projected into a realm where it's punished by the Yamadutas under the direction of Yamaraj. And you read the fifth canto, the very last chapter in the fifth canto, in the hellish planets, descriptions of the sufferings of the living entities are there. So to have a human form of life is a great benediction, and to misuse that is a very unfortunate situation, because human form of life is a way out. It's the only way out, really. And to not to take advantage of that, one is considered to be, the word is kripana. Kripana means miserly. Sometimes we say miserly is a person who doesn't know the value of something. A miser is a person who just hoards money without spending it. Therefore, he really doesn't know the value of the money. The value of the money is in its purchasing power, not in its accumulation. And so, therefore, one who doesn't use this human form of life is considered to be a miser, because they have something valuable, but they don't know how to use it. So that is the understanding. So therefore, the punishment is great because of that misuse of the human form of life. Yes, Bill, you had a question?
A lot of times I wonder, why Krishna designed it. It seems like everything that's good for you is hard to do, like vegetables and broccoli and stuff. You don't want it, but it's good for you. And things that you like are bad for you, like candy and, whatever.
Yeah.
I just wonder why Krishna designed it like that.
Well, they say one man's food is another man's poison. Just like we see that in this world, people are engaged in various forms of sense gratification. And now, the more intelligent you are, and the higher your position you are, generally, the more you engage in different types of sense gratification. The more you are in ignorance, the more you are engaged in the more grosser forms of sense gratification. So we find that on this existence, you find that there's different forms of sense gratification. But for some people, one form of sense gratification is just abominable. Another form of sense gratification is very pleasing. Prabhupada uses the example that in Burma, there's a festival every year in Burma, wherein, in order to prepare for that festival, what happens is that all the dead animals that they find throughout the year, they take and throw in this big vat. And this vat has a lid on it. So they take the dead animal and they throw it in the vat. And then it decomposes, all these rotten animals. And at the end of the year, just prior to the festival, whatever liquid comes off, that they take that off, and it's used as a condiment on the food during the festival. So disgusting, to say the least. But one man's food is another man's poison. So what is pleasing for one person, and we can understand, is not for another person. It depends on your grade of life. In the higher planetary systems, people have higher forms of sense gratification. So as you make advancement in life, you find that what pleases you changes. So you might say that at one time eating candy or just getting intoxicated is a form of pleasure, but for another person that's abominable. His pleasure is something else. But even higher than that, there's yogis who have to have the pleasure of having mystic powers. And they control people, they can manipulate material energy. That's a form of sense gratification, the idea of being powerful. It's still sense gratification. So that's a higher form of sense gratification. So sense gratification is sense gratification. There's abominable types of sense gratification, and there's what we call more laudable or more esteemed forms of sense gratification, but it's all sense gratification. So as we evolve in our consciousness, we find that our forms of sense gratification change. They change. But it's still all sense gratification, so... Okay. Does that answer your question? So whether it's one form or another, we shouldn't be so concerned. What we're interested is in Krishna consciousness, not this or that. Krishna gives us some austerities. Eat this, don't eat this. Act like this, don't act like this. We have things to do and things not to do. So as one lives in different forms of material life, the restrictions are changed, they're different. For one class of people, there's one type of restrictions. For others, there are other types of restrictions. But ultimately, we're not interested in any of these. We're interested in what Krishna wants for us in devotional service. So in devotional service, in order to execute Krishna consciousness, if Krishna is asking us to do something, then that becomes a source of... that becomes a conscious endeavor to do that, because that's what Krishna wants. Krishna consciousness means doing what Krishna wants. So for a devotee, there's no question of whether it's easy or hard. It's just a matter of just carrying out Krishna's instructions. Okay? So when Krishna says no meat, fish, or eggs, we can understand to eat meat, fish, or eggs is not good for us, both spiritually and materially. So we'd say no. That's all. We eat Krishna prasad. Yes.
What happens then if at the time of death, let's say the devotee, pretty much say Krishna and so on, perhaps the circumstances are that he might think that something else at the last minute? Would he lose everything?
Therefore, there must be a controlled atmosphere during the time of death. There's a book that just came out by Stephen Knapp, Sri Nandanandana, who wrote a book called Facing Death. And he explains what one can do to exit in a God-conscious way. Things to do and things not to do to make the exit more successful. So yes, if you are about to die, it's not good to be surrounded by persons who you maybe have some attachment to. Better to be away from that. And better not to be in a situation of a person maybe you had some difficulty with, unless you make amends before the time of death, because that consciousness will carry with you. So being in the time of death is a very, very, very important part of our life, and that environment should be controlled very carefully. We find that even very sinful people, in the very end of their life, if they make some accelerated attempts, they can purify their consciousness to a large degree and get a much better destination if certain precautions are taken. So I would suggest we can study the things to do and things not to do at the time of death. It's not just a matter of leaving. It's a matter of controlling the environment in such a way that everything is auspicious. Just like lately I've been around people who are some of their relatives have been dying. So what they do is they play Prabhupada's bhajans. They have pictures of Krishna everywhere. They bring in Tulsi leaves and Ganges water. And the atmosphere is always very spiritual, like that. Like that. And they should be around people who are spiritual, not just ordinary people who bring them down, who cry. People who cry around you, they're the worst. as you start crying too, and then what do you think about them at the time of death? It's a mess. And so therefore there should be some proper arrangements for exiting this material world. Okay, one quick question.
In terms of thinking of unexpected death, such as sudden illness, accident.
Yeah, accident.
That kind of destiny.
Usually that happens. But still, therefore one has to practice Krishna consciousness. When if you practice Krishna consciousness at the time of, during your life, if sudden death comes, you will think of Krishna. And even if you're not able to think of Krishna, if you're a devotee, Krishna will help you at the time of death. There's no question. I know one devotee, he was driving in a car, and the car jumped the guardrail, and they were on the other side of the road, and they were ready to have a head-on crash. And he couldn't think of Krishna, but because he was a devotee, he said in his mind, he saw the Maha Mantra. His mind immediately went on to the Maha Mantra. Krishna came in the form of his holy name. And he could see the mantra in his mind. And so, he didn't die, but this was Krishna's special mercy. That if you live a devotional life, even if you're unable to think of Krishna fully at the time of death, by Krishna's mercy, he will help. But if you're not, then you're pretty much on your own. Good luck. Okay, I think our pujari is telling us time is up. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada.